All right, my name is Seth Koch with the Southern Oral History Program at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The date remains unknown to me, as it often does. August 22nd. Thank you very much. August 22nd, 2014, and I am here at the Regulator in Durham, North Carolina, with Tom Campbell, the co-founder and co-owner of the Regulator. Mr. Campbell, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You can imagine we're on television.
Right.
So I just wanted to ask you a little bit about your early life, about the sort of path, long or short, that eventually led you to Duke.
Right. Well, let's see. Early years, I was an Army brat. My father was in the military. Second War, I was born in 48. He went back into the Army after the Second World War. Fought in Korea. My earliest memories are in Japan. Then we eventually found our way back to Philadelphia.
And is that where you were born?
I was born in Philadelphia, yeah. And my father left the Army for a second time and stayed out this time. He went to work for United Airlines, and we lived outside of Philadelphia. I grew up there. Came to Duke in 1966. Mostly I wanted to go to a school in a different part of the country, see something different. My father had been in North Carolina, basic training at Fort Bragg for the in the early 40s, and liked it, and so we came down to see Duke. Anyway, I ended up coming to go to school here. I was the first, my sister was the first person in our extended family to go to college. I was the first male in our extended family to go to college.
And did you, had you been to the South before you made that trip?
No, not really. And you know, clearly got some indications that things were different. Down here, in some ways. I mean, obviously, I remember on the drive down, stopping at a gas station somewhere in Virginia, and there were signs for, you know, colored bathroom, right? They had been painted over because the law said they needed to be painted over, but it was just one coat of paint and you could still see the lettering. And I went, ah, okay.
Quite literally following the letter of the law.
Yes.
So this was in 1966 that you would have made the visit, and sort of immediately after.
Yeah, 65, I guess. Yeah.
So were those kinds of visible signs, both literal and figurative, of racial segregation, I'm assuming they were less evident in Philadelphia?
They were less overt signs.
Right.
There was still, you know, obvious and large amount of racial segregation, racial prejudice, racial tensions, et cetera, et cetera.
And were your parents newspaper readers or television viewers, or were you?
Yes, yeah. They read newspapers all the time, watched news a lot. My father in particular was really, I think maybe from his experience in the wars, whatever, he was a very, very open person, open to all kinds of people, I think taught me a lot about, you know, just approaching people for who they are, and not getting caught up in labels, whether it be race, religion, anything like that. So came to Duke. The 60s started happening. I mean, it was the war, and there were obviously, you know, issues of race that were more apparent here than there had been in Philadelphia. I think it was the war in particular that got me involved and engaged in thinking about just thinking about things and starting to take a different look at what was going on. So
was that because of the, and the draft hadn't come along yet, but
right.
was that something because you felt a sort of personal sense of risk, or was there something else there?
Well, no, it wasn't at that point. It wasn't a personal sense of risk, but it was, you know, it was kind of, it was very much consuming the country, and you know, every time you turned on the news, there it was, and it just didn't seem. I don't know. The more you looked into it, the more it was like, what are we doing? Why are we doing this kind of thing? And I remember my father even, this was about 1968, he turned against the war, which was, he was, you know, he voted Republican, was, you know, certainly pro-military, but what was happening, there's a big military hospital at Valley Forge, and so they were bringing wounded soldiers back to be treated there. But they didn't want people to see that there were all these wounded soldiers coming back. So the planes were landing in the middle of the night and out in a deserted part of the airport at Philadelphia where he was working. And he was just, this made him really, really angry. I mean, he felt that these people should be honored for what they had done. And if the government felt they had to hide this, these people from notice, that there must be something wrong with, you know, with what we're doing. So that was, I remember that was a big surprise, because we would argue about the war. Mm. And then all of a sudden he was like, yeah, I've had it. With that as well, so. Yeah.
When you came down to Durham, did you seek out sources of information, or were they plentiful? That is to say, newspapers, radio, TV?
Well, yeah. I mean, read the local papers, read the New York Times every now and then.
And I'm sorry, were the Herald Sun?
Herald. And the Herald Sun. And then, you know, there were starting to be alternative papers, the Radish,
mm-hmm.
right, and the North Carolina Anvil,
mm-hmm.
That I read a lot, and the New Chronicle, which, you know, reprinted both New York Times Wire Service things as well as their own reporting, and I think it was second semester of my sophomore year, I went up to the Chronicle office and said, hey, you know, I like to work. Be interested in working here, so doing some things. And yeah, one thing I remember, and it's too bad that apparently all these tapes were destroyed.
Hmm.
Many of us, well, Jesse Helms was on WRAL,
right,
as a commentator, and many of us would take time out just to go listen to him, because he was so outrageous, and it was so obvious, you know. His coded racist things were just barely coded. I mean, anyone with any sense could tell what he was talking about, what he was saying. And we were just, you know, amazed to watch him. But somehow all those tapes just disappeared.
Somehow. Yeah. You know, I will say that the transcripts are in print at UNC. So they won't carry the same kind of power,
but
the words are there, at least as around.
Yeah.
Did you ever listen to J.D. Lewis, the broadcaster, who sometimes he would have been on before or after Jesse Helms, and he was an African American, who they walked the same halls but had very different political perspectives.
Yeah, I don't remember him.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
So when you approached the Chronicle your sophomore year, at that point were you studying? I believe you graduated with a degree eventually in environmental management.
Well, like a master's degree. I got my undergraduate degree was in American history.
Okay,
yeah.
So you were studying history. They took you on, I imagine.
Right.
Do you remember some of the early stories that you did, or what your beat was?
There wasn't a beat.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just did general reporting on all kinds of things, from student government to, I remember going to I think the first story I wrote was about a meeting of a group that was kind of into this, I guess he was a Hindu spiritual leader called Mayor Baba. So I reported on that, which was, you know, not what I expected to be doing here, but, you know, people liked the story, so.
Around then, it must have been before or after, there was the vigil following the assassination of Martin Luther King and the occupation of Douglas Knight's house. Do you remember that?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Very much. Yeah. I mean, I was involved in that as a participant, wrote a little bit about it. That was, I remember, Knight was trying to be, everybody marched out to his house, and the four demands, I can only remember a couple of them right now, but there were a couple of them that we thought were just slam dunks, you know, that having him resign from the Hope Valley Country Club, a segregated country club, you know, being to talk with the people that were had formed a non-academic employees union. We thought, okay, they don't have to, you know, recognize union, they don't have to, you know, and resigning from this country club. And we were amazed that he wouldn't do any of it. But he was, I don't know, a polite person. And so when everybody got out to his house, he invited people in. Which is how we ended up kind of occupying his house the first night. Because we got in and went, okay, why don't we just stay here? If he's not going to say yes, we'll stay here. So, yeah.
There was someone had told me about he had greeted students in his robe. Maybe it was evening. And then had at some point sort of disappeared. And it turned out that he was ill, but there was a rumor that he had sort of scurried away to conceal himself.
Yeah, I think he wasn't feeling well.
Not quite as dramatic a story as one might wish. Do you remember the vigil after the
The vigil, we marched back to campus and then set up on the quad. I remember a fair amount about that.
Can you talk a little bit about what stands out for you as you think about it?
I don't know. It kept going on, and there were people, I think, one's memory at 40 years, 40-some years. So Pete Seeger came to town for something, I think. Was it the vigil?
Yeah, I think it might have been.
Yeah, I think it was. He was in, close by and came by, and yes, it was a vigil, yeah.
I spoke to Arnie Katz about that, and he said that Pete Seeger was sort of surprised to hear him saying that he was angry, and that he had a rock in his guitar case that he's sort of ready to stir something up.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think he would have actually thrown a rock.
I doubt that too. Although
he was angry because that nobody was paying attention to us because there was no violence. Is what he was saying. That only, you know, you have to be violent to get attention, and that was wrong. And, you know, so I think he was saying, so I've got a rock. You know,
But sort of a funny parallel to I've got a hammer. So, I mean, obviously you were connected in some degree with some kind of activist community or activist impulse at Duke.
The people that ran the newspaper were close with the people, the activists, and, you know, it was, we did journalism, but sometimes, I mean, we had a point of view, let's say. We promoted that, certainly, through what we covered, the way we covered it.
So when you became editor, would that have been your senior year?
My senior year.
So 1970.
69, 70.
69, 70, okay.
Yeah, but
So, an interesting time, I mean, following the turmoil and the sort of peak of activism in 1968, but also maybe building towards something with the war.
Yeah, well, and in the spring of 69, the African American Students Institute, black students took over the Mallon Building, took over the administration building, and that was led to this huge riot on the quad with state police battling white students on the quad. And that was something where the connections between the Chronicle and activists came into play because the black students told Mark Pinsky the night before. Have you heard this story? Okay. They told him that they were going to take over the administration building the next morning at 6 o'clock, right? 7 o'clock, I think, when the doors opened. And they wanted him to tell the five or six of us, the top staff of the Chronicle, so that we would be able to be there and get on the phones right away and let the national media know that this was happening, because they thought if there was national media attention, it'd be less likely that Duke would call on the police right away. So they thought that would give them protection. So Mark got us together like 10 o'clock at night and said, "This is going to happen tomorrow morning." So that was pretty an interesting situation. I mean, we didn't, we all kept it. Nobody told anybody else, and very unusual for students. We get up at like 6 o'clock the next morning, and we're on the phones at 7 o'clock.
So were you in touch generally with the national media?
At times, yeah. I mean, certainly there were some reporters for the New York Times that covered civil rights issues and that covered the South that we knew, and they knew us. And when they would come to town, they would always come by, and talk. So, yeah.
And so, in this particular case, did they take your call? Did the strategy work?
Oh, they took the call. Yes, I remember. Being in an administrator's office at 9 o'clock that morning, the Africans, the black students had taken over the first floor of our building, and he had the radio on, and the news came on, and the story was on the national news on the radio, and I remember him turning his head to the radio and going, "Damn." And I thought, oh, good. But it didn't work in that they called in the state police. They came on at 2 o'clock in the afternoon to evict the students. Luckily for Duke, the students went out. The state police came out a side door. The students went out another side door. They had word that this was going to happen. They left the building, and then the state police were in the building, and the building at that point was then surrounded by white students who had been there to kind of help protect the black students. And anyway, then the state police were just as angry at the white hippies and political folks and a riot, tear gassing and stuff up and down the quad ensued. So I remember going to, I think it was just a year ago, year and a half ago, an anniversary thing about the takeover of Allen Building, and I was very surprised that everybody was saying how well Duke responded to this. And afterwards, 6 months afterwards, Duke did started to respond well, but their immediate response was disastrous. And if the black students had not left the building, Duke today would be a very different place. I mean, they would have gotten, people could have died, I'm sure. The North Carolina State Police in 1968, yes, that would have been an incredibly ugly situation. People would have gotten really hurt badly. So it was lucky for Duke that the students left. If they hadn't left, I I think Duke's effort to become a national university would have been really set back.
So I may be asking you to state the obvious here, but it sounds like it would have been normal for you, even as a white student, and others to expect for the state police to come ready to use violence to control or to sort of handle the situation. Was something that was sort of an assumption or an expectation?
And I think, look at what's happening in Missouri today. Even police and minority communities, there are issues. Well, the North Carolina State Police in 1968, I think, that was, to say there were issues would be pretty mildly. This was absolutely all white force, and and integration was fairly new. A new idea.
Sure.
So,
reflecting on what's going on in Missouri, just thinking of the way in which these issues it feels like they bubble up fairly frequently, but it still feels to some extent like it's surprising to a certain community that, for instance, African Americans' parents have their talk with their sons or have more of a sense of threat from police. Whereas, and I have a young son, it had struck me to have a talk with him about how to interact with a police officer in order to preserve his physical safety. And obviously, 40 years ago, very different in some ways, very similar in others. But I was wondering if that sense of threat was just maybe spread out a little bit more, whereas in an odd way it would feel like in a more racially segregated society the white people would feel less at risk, whereas here, anyway, I'm obviously
rambling. I think that there was some feeling of threat among if you were young, white, had long hair, were involved in in that situation, all these people were there, obviously, to support the black students who had taken over the building. We were seen as somebody other as well.
When you were sort of operating during this crisis, the situation, were you? I may be asking you to not only remember an incredible degree of self-awareness, but also to have had it during this time period. But were you sort of trying to juggle your role as the editor of the paper versus an activist versus just a Duke student versus someone who was just kind of maybe caught up in a quick moving scenario?
Yeah. I mean, I was very close to one of the doors of Allen Building because I was there to report on what was happening. I wanted to see what was happening. I wanted to be as close as I could. And, and then when all of a sudden the police started tear-gassing people, I realized, they're not going to exactly be able to recognize that, he's okay because he's a reporter. No, that wasn't, at that point I needed to take care of myself. But I still wanted to be able to see as much as I could of what was going on. So I was trying to stay out, not just run away, but not be directly in the, the line of fire. I mean, they never took out guns or anything, but they were very angry, obviously. When the Kent State shootings happened a year later, I kind of went, I could see, that kind of thing could have happened, at Duke. I could see that, this was National Guard troops, but those people get so angry, they just go, okay.
Can you talk a little bit about what the day-to-day operations of the paper were?
It had just my junior year, the paper went daily for the first time. It had been 3 times a week, and the editor that year, Alan Ray, he was a great editor and incredibly organized and really made that happen. And then that all got worked out very seamlessly. And I luckily inherited that. I inherited, staff. Like, my managing editor was a guy named Bob Ashley, who's now the editor of the Herald Sun in Durham. He stayed in journalism. I had some, I didn't have as much experience with the day-to-day operations as other people did, having just started, my sophomore year. There were people that just made everything happen. We had a couple employees who worked in our offices who did the layout, and it was all done by hand, mocking up things, and then those were taken over to a press in Mebane, driven over there, 11 o'clock at night, and the press in Mebane printed the newspaper, and somebody went over there early the next morning, picked them up, brought them back to campus, and distributed them. I remember, I went over there a number of times just to, oh, this person couldn't make it, okay, I'll drive it over, or pick them up and, drive them back. There was, I mean, everything was written on typewriters, right? Triple spaced. You type things out so that there'd be lots of room for writing in edits and changes in the space between the lines. Then they would be typeset. Those articles would be typeset and then pasted up into a, the paste up of the pages of the paper. There was a New York Times wire linotype machine, maybe it was called. No, I forget what it was called. Anyway, it was a machine that fed, it clattered like a typewriter and just fed lines and lines of stories. And I remember two interesting things about that. One, when there was a really, since it would, when times were slow, it would advance like obituaries of people that were still alive. I mean, they have obituary writers, and that's what they do, right? But it was like, okay, if this person dies, then you've got this, So you had a stock of these written obituaries, right, of people. Now they just have that at the Times, and they send it out. But if there was, since it was pretty much constantly advancing stories, if there was something really important that happened, a bell rang on this machine, and then it was like, oh, pay attention, what's coming next is a big story, and so that was, that was kind of exciting. I remember, I guess in the early 90s, walking into a newsroom and, it's totally silent, right? I mean, people are typing at their computers, there's nothing in, the newsroom I worked in, everybody was pounding on typewriters. There was this New York Times machine spewing out things. It was, it was a cacophony, and it was like, ah, this is exciting. It sounded exciting, right? Whereas a newsroom today is just quiet.
Well, there's something to be said, maybe, I mean, in a variety of formats about the sterility of communication and how it's gotten a little bit less romantic and a little bit cleaned up over the years.
I think, I mean, this was sort of some of the heydays of journalism, if you look at it from that the point of view of today. But yeah, I think there was sort of a romance to it. That was good. I worked for a little while the summer after I graduated on the afternoon newspaper in Greensboro. There was such a thing then,
right.
Greensboro Record. And I remember at one point covering a school board meeting, and the meeting ran late, and I got out late, and you know, got on a phone. There were no cell phones. Called the editor, and I said, oh, I'm not going to be able to make the deadline. Meeting just ended, and he said, we've got 15 minutes. Just dictate the story. And I said, I haven't written it. He said, just take a minute, and then start telling me the story. You know, I'll type it. And I went, huh? Really? So I went, okay, I'll try. And I did. You know, I just, okay, this will be the lead in this. You know, and I was, it was kind of fun to realize that I could do that. You know, I got to the point where I could just, I didn't have to sit down at a typewriter and have to, you know, edit. I could just, I mean, it was a, it wasn't a very complex story, but still, you know, it was neat. So.
I have the image in my head of, you know, a movie from the 40s or something with a newspaper man with that fedora on banging on a phone booth to get in, you know, to get
right,
you know,
right.
The woman and her dog or something off the phone so he can dictate the story.
Right, yeah.
I don't want to try to ask too much of the, you know, the 20-year-old or 21-year-old you, but when you were editor, did you have sort of a vision or when you were maybe trying to articulate why you wanted to be editor at the time to your peers, or maybe let me back up and ask how you were selected as editor, or maybe you
there were two people who had Bob Ashley, who was the managing editor, being one of them, that were the more obvious candidates, and for personal reasons and things going on with them and all, they somewhere near the last minute just said, you know, I don't want to do it. And then people turned around, looked at me, kind of really? So, you know, so it was, stumbled into it, in those ways. Yeah. But I really, It felt like I really enjoyed being part of, you know, it was kind of the nerve center of things that were happening. And there were a lot of things happening then. It was a good time for news. And our, you know, our approach, the Chronicle today, I picked it up yesterday. You know, it's distributed here at the bookstore. You know, the lead story was about how More people that got accepted at Duke ended up going to Duke this year than any year since 1979, and it was like, you know, it was all about how, and lots of their stories now are almost PR kind of for the university, and you know, they're taking pride in being there and what's happening, and our approach was pretty much 180 degrees from that. You know, it was like, boy, there are things wrong here. We need to let people know, try and get them changed. Yeah. So, yeah.
Did you have relationships with administrators?
Did, and well, some professors certainly. One of the big changes after the Black students took over Allen Building, there was a struggle within the Board of Trustees. That ended with Terry Sanford being selected as the next president. And he came on the beginning of my senior year. At the beginning of the year, I was editor. I remember I got a call from him personally, the first day that he was in office, asking me if I could come see him the next day to talk. And I was amazed because that kind of thing had never happened with any editor or, you know, and he was a politician. He was, and he realized that the Chronicle was played an important role in lots of things that were going on campus. And he wanted to, you know, set up some lines of communication and talk, and went over and he was a good old boy Southern politician. We spent the first 15 minutes just kind of chatting about Duke, about our you know, where I was from, what I was studying, just telling stories, you know, getting to know each other a little bit before we brought up any issue of substance whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And that was refreshing. That was good. So it was different.
I could see how that kind of a meeting could be construed as intimidating by the student.
But it yeah, like no, but he was not being intimidated. And we were cocky enough, I think, that we were not going to, we were not going to be intimidated.
So you knew not to bother. So you've mentioned Mark Pinsky and Bob Ashley. Were there others that you worked closely with that you might be able to name?
Clay Steinman, mm-hmm. who was the editor the next year, Bob Entman, who I mentioned before. They were two people that I was close with and worked with a lot.
Were there many women or African Americans on the staff?
Well, yes. So this picture only worked because there was only one woman at the time on the editorial board, mm-hmm. and she couldn't make it for that picture. I mean, we wouldn't have been able to do that.
Okay. Well, I mean, we were talking about this before we
joined. And the board of trustees were all white males, and so were we. Right. Yeah. So,
well, it does make for a nice symmetry. But I should say that we were speaking about this before the recorder was turned on, and we have Nostalgia Dump. Is that how do we pronounce?
This is this is the Duke yearbook. I forget what it was called.
Okay.
And this is they just put that on. There were two volumes of it.
And can you would you just mind just briefly describing the picture or the juxtaposition?
Yeah, it was. There's a page with at the top half of the page is a picture of the executive committee of the board of trustees. Taken in the room that the executive committee met in. Below that is a picture of the editorial board of the Chronicle, taken in the same room of the board of trustees room. We are all, as I said, all white men, and we have our shirts off with our clenched fists up on the table. I have a bit of a, like, I can't believe I'm doing this smile on my face. But, it was the editor of the yearbook had the idea of bring us over there for the picture, and Bob Entman, as we were walking over there, came up with the idea of let's take our shirts off and have clenched fists. So,
So as you were wrapping up your tenure as editor, were there other major stories that you sort of remember really delving into?
I don't remember details of a lot. I remember we had, we went out into the Durham community some, mm-hmm. and I remember going to interview, there was a man named Howard Fuller, mm-hmm. who was kind of the leader of, he worked for a Operation Breakthrough, I think, at the time. And he was a leader of the black community, and lived right near North Carolina Central. Going to both interview him, but also to kind of compare notes about other things that he was doing and people were doing at North Carolina Central that activists at Duke could work with, mm-hmm. and vice versa. Mm-hmm. Could we work together in some ways? And I remember in particular that because this would have been 1969, going to see him. He lived in an apartment that was in a house that was up. You parked down the street, and then you had to climb stairs up the side of a hill to get to the house. And sitting in front of his house was another young black man with a shotgun across his lap, which I was like, whoa. Was not expecting to see that, but especially having read some things just in the last 10 years about the racial situation in Durham and this area of North Carolina around that time, it made perfect sense. It makes perfect sense to me that he would have had that you know, and there were things come out about, you know, the police in Durham were, you know, they were not likely to help him in any way, if, and the Klan was still very active, and he was an incredibly public figure at the time, so, yeah.
Were there substantive connections between Duke and either other activist communities outside of Duke University or HBCUs in the area, like Central or elsewhere?
Well, there were some ties with some folks at Central, not a lot, but some.
Yeah.
Beyond that, not a lot. The people that worked and ran the North Carolina Anvil at the time interacted with people in the community and with people on campus, and they were, I think, more involved in making those connections. Yeah.
And were papers like The Radish and The Anvil distributed widely on campus or read widely?
Well, The Anvil was, yeah. The Radish, not as much. I mean, it was seen as, you know, it was out there. You
yeah.
know,
mm-hmm. So after graduation, do you go straight into your degree program?
No, I did a number of things. I worked at a school. I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I worked in journalism for a while. Then I worked, I got a job. I was a teacher at a school for emotionally disturbed children, an assistant, you know, not a teacher. Then I was waiting tables, tending bar. And
in Durham?
In Durham.
Where?
Yeah, at a there was a vegetarian restaurant called Sometime on Broad Street. And then I decided I'd go back to school and get a degree in environmental studies. And I was thinking of maybe doing environmental journalism even out of that. But yeah. Then I got married. My wife was getting a degree in public health at UNC. Master's degree at the time, and then I got my degree for master's in environmental management a year before she was finishing. I couldn't find a job in this area with my degree, and our idea was, well, when she finished, we would go someplace and get jobs. And meanwhile, some friends that I'd gone to Duke with, a lot of us were still in Durham, and there had always been this pipe dream of, oh, somebody should start a bookstore in Durham. Durham needs a bookstore. So we would always go to Chapel Hill to go to the Intimate, to go to a bookstore.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And that was, I mean, that was something we did on a regular basis. And so what happened is the front third of the upstairs of this building came available, and one of the people put down a month's rent on it and said, well, here's a space we could open a bookstore, and called a meeting. And I said, well, I'm not doing anything for the next few months. I'll help out, help get it started. That was, you know, 37 years ago. So, yeah.
So this is 1976 or 77?
76. Okay. It opened in December 76.
Okay. That's funny,
yeah,
because I've seen it. Its founding stated as both 76 and 77, and it
yeah,
sounds like it was
yeah,
perfectly
it was right
on the cusp.
At the end of 76.
Yeah.
We were desperate to get open before Christmas.
So how did you get your first? How does one acquire books to sell? I don't even. I don't know today, I don't know then.
Well, you know, then, I don't know these days, but anyway, we were able to get a small bank loan, and we got some individual loans, and we just had some money, and we set up accounts with publishers, and we had to prepay our first orders, and and we got into books and opened the door.
Presumably you were a reader?
Oh, yeah. I mean, not... I still don't read... You know, I read 3 books a month, maybe. I mean, I'm not a voracious reader the way some people are, but, yeah, I've always read a lot, yeah. Although it took me a few years after I got out of college to get back in the habit of reading, because I think college can destroy your... your taste for reading, because you have to, there's all the stuff you have to read, and enough of it is stuff that you'd rather not read, but you still have to, mm-hmm. that, you know, reading can get a bit of a negative connotation.
Mm-hmm. So. They say that with children, too, that, you know, sort of assigning reading can create a that sense of obligation that later in life is unpleasant.
Yeah. And I now, you know, think nothing of.
Right.
I'll start four books and get a little bit into it and go, no, you know, I'll just put it aside. If it's, you know, I read for pleasure and interest and to learn certain things.
Yeah. It's funny that you say that, because I feel like there's some point that one passes where one gives oneself permission to stop reading a book halfway in without losing faith in yourself.
Yes. Well, you should. It's the way it should be done. Yeah.
Right. So when did you have a point where you kind of realized that this commitment you'd made of a few months was going to turn into something more substantial?
It just kind of evolved. My wife finished her degree, then she got work here, and I was really enjoying what I was doing, and, you know, things were happening, and the store was kind of part of a, you know, a little community, and so we just kind of went, well, let's just stay here, so...
Can you talk a little bit about that community that the store fit into?
Well, originally it was a lot of folks like myself who had gone to Duke but stayed in Durham, including John Valentine there. My partner, he came on 2 years after the store opened. But he had been a customer. He kept coming in the store. For a good many years, when we needed to hire somebody, we thought of our customers first. You know, like, well, this person's, you know, we know them, we know they're in the books, and so, yeah. But the store opened, I remember some of our early ads had to do with, you know, a new store with a focus on politics and alternative energy and feminism, and, you know, we were kind of trying to set ourselves as just not another Walden Books, which was what the standard for bookstores was at the time.
So it was explicitly an alternative bookstore, even though it was also kind of the only bookstore.
Hey, John Valentine. Yeah. Good to see you.
Nice to see you, too.
Yeah. And who are you with?
Carolina
Oral History.
Oh, great.
Mm-hmm. We started with me and the Chronicle.
Doing a project on media and activism and alternative media and radio and all that kind of good stuff in the 60s and beyond.
Yeah, it was great. We're in such a supportive place.
Yeah.
So are you going to talk to Celeste Wesson? Is she somebody on your list?
I am emailing with her right now.
Great.
I have to find a way to get out to L.A.
Yeah. Right. Oh, you'll find a way. Where there's a will. Good luck.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah.
So it was, were you, as the owner of this bookstore, in sort of conversation with other, with journalists or with activists or with others who might have been part of a natural community, or
a lot of it was those people came into the store,
right
they gravitated to the store, and I still, you know, working here, just being out on the sales floor, get to see all kinds of folks, and you know, renew ties with people and keep ties up with folks over the years, and so that's certainly one of the great things about doing this.
Can you talk a little bit about the role that a bookstore plays in keeping that kind of community alive, especially in comparison or contrast with more kind of overtly on the nose activist style activities?
I'm not sure how much I can talk about that, because I'm kind of from the inside, and how people say from the outside. I've often, one of the ways I like to think about the store sometimes is a very low-key, indirect kind of means of activism, which is, you know, people could come in here, feel comfortable, feel safe, and browse, and maybe start to have an interest, start to get exposed to some things that they wouldn't have otherwise. And that's, you know, that may sound Pollyannish, but I think it happens sometimes. I think that, and I think that just providing, for people that are into activism and politics more overtly, providing a place where they can find, things that give them background, that give them depth, that, where they can, and that we've gone out and kind of curated the collection of books we have here. And we still, I still, when I'm ordering books and ordering new titles, very often know a couple people that, this person are going to be interested in that book. That's something that they're going to want to look at, if not read. But, we can order things that fit the community that we're serving.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. So.
Well, there's plenty of academic work on how important space is for activism, period. Just having a place to meet.
Yeah. And, certainly through, we do all kinds of events here with all kinds of authors, but we get, more authors that have something going on politically or socially or, even with fiction that are doing something different. That can provide a venue for people to come in and talk and kind of compare notes as well.
You've spoken a lot about the role of reading in books and bookstores, especially in contrast with internet shopping for books and things of that nature.
Yeah.
Do you feel that there's a? I think there are some ways in which the internet and those styles of communication have helped activist causes. There are maybe ways in which they've harmed activist causes. I don't want to ask you to take one side or the other necessarily, but I'm curious if you could reflect a little bit on the sort of role books play in one form or another, in whether it's creating an activist community or educating an activist community, and maybe how you might have seen that change over time. I realize it's a very broad and rambling kind of question. I welcome a broad and rambling answer and response.
Yeah. I'm not sure where to go with that. First, I think the internet, there's some things that it's great for and it does easier, but in some ways it, promises more than it delivers, and lots of things. I remember when, the Arab Spring was getting underway, there was all this stuff in the press about, the internet is making this possible, and I thought back to just my own days as, going to political demonstrations. I went to a number of them in D.C. and the things we did at Duke and it was, but are you going to, go out there and risk your life with someone that you've met on Facebook and you haven't spent any time with and you don't know and you haven't built an actual human relationship with? I don't think so. There's only so far that can go, I think, in terms of building a real community. I think people have to, get to know each other, spend time together, do things together, and a step at a time before you get to the point of, especially if you're doing any kind of activism that where there could be some pushback, and there may be some consequences for what you're doing. You really have to know and trust the people you're with, and that there's a degree of which that's not going to happen on the internet. As far as how you can't say that people who have read those same books are going to feel that way either, you know. So, but I think, you know, people that have done, you know, that read, and that read not just in a narrow little sense, but read somewhat in a wider way. I don't know, that hopefully they've got some that can bring some more depth of understanding and some more take people out of a narrow approach to things. You know, I think that, you know, you have to be, to get things done, you have to be focused, obviously, and, you know, your activism has to be focused. But if you're if you're kind of in an ideological straitjacket, that's usually not very helpful either. I from the 60s and 70s, there were folks that were, you know, this is the way things are, this is the way, this is what has to happen, and that's that. And, you know, it's like it was hard to have a conversation with them, you know, and they weren't very flexible in terms of responding to the nuances of a situation.
What do you see? I mean, you've reflected on this publicly before, and so I don't want to make you retread your steps too much, but can you talk a little bit about how bookstores have changed since you first started running The Regulator to today, and maybe where you see bookstores going, or maybe even just The Regulator going?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, things have changed enormously, and the internet is the biggest change. There's two things there. One, obviously, is Amazon, and, you know, you can buy anything, you can get it cheap, you can get it there in a few days, and so that's competition. And I think, you know, again, there are things that you can't do on Amazon, like, you know, the experience of physically browsing in a bookstore. You can't browse on Amazon. That's really hard to do. If you know what you want, you can go get it there. But if, you know, again, you're not going to be exposed to things that you don't know what you want, that you want them before you went there, mm-hmm. as much. And that's, you know, a role that I think a good bookstore should play for people. The other thing, though, I think, is that people's time is so taken up now with being online, on their phones, on their laptops, on their computers at work, and their attention spans are so chopped up, I'm guilty of this as well. I find myself, you know, God, what did I do today? You know, I did a little this, little this, little this, and, you know, I didn't really. I need to focus on this, but I keep not getting time to focus on this because all this stuff keeps popping up that I feel I need to respond to. But I think that people's attention spans are sometimes to the point where the idea of reading a whole book is a challenge. And these are, you know, otherwise smart, literate people who 20 years ago would have read more books, and I think they're not reading as many books now because they're just not used to it. They've gotten out of the habit of that kind of deep engagement with text and, you know, either the ideas in a book or the world that a fictional book is creating. You know, so I think that's as big an issue for bookstores in the future as anything.
Yeah. It's hard not to feel a little bit gloomy.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, sometimes I feel like, you know, I'm doing a rear guard action here. but it's a rear guard action worth doing. And I think, you know, things may yet come back around. I think people may at some point go, books may become a retro cool thing.
Vinyl had its biggest year in years last year, right?
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
There's something about the sort of toil of doing activist work where I guess you never really get to stop and have a party.
Yeah.
To just keep pushing and pushing and pushing. Does it feel that way when you're working in this kind of environment?
Yeah, sometimes. Yeah, it's like, you know, there's always this detail, this needs doing. And it's hard to stop sometimes and one, appreciate that, hey, you know, I'm getting to do work in this environment doing this general job. That's a great life. That's a nice thing to have done than to be doing. We should have, we had a big party in, this was, you know, 7 years ago now, for our 30th anniversary here. And the place was mobbed. We had like 250 people. And I remember John O. Franklin was one of our customers. And, you know, we sent him a special invitation along with a number of authors, but I thought, well, you know, I mean, he was well into his 80s, and, you know, he came, and he was just thrilled, and he was, you know, well, I don't get invited to too many real parties these days. Right. And so I was like, okay, that's great. So, yeah, that we should do something like that more often.
I'm wondering if you know or think why the regulator has persisted when other stores like the Intimate, for instance, is now kind of long gone.
I may ask that question sometimes, but I don't have a, you know, some of it I think it's just luck. We're in a good location. Luck. We bought our building some years back, and so our overhead is manageable. Durham's a great community for supporting a bookstore, that's certainly played a role. And you know, we do an all right job running the store. I mean, I know a lot of other booksellers. I was on the board of directors of the American Bookseller Association for 6 years, and you know, there were some great booksellers out there that do all kinds of amazing creative things. sometimes I go, oh wow, we don't do half of that, but you know, but I think we've learned to kind of reinvent the place, and you know, to keep it going, and we're, you know, we don't know what else to do at this point, so you know, so keep going. You know.
I think that's probably a pretty good point to end our conversation.
Right,
but
right.
But I do want to ask if there's anything else that you wanted to add or that I should have asked you that I didn't.
Not that I can think of. This has been pretty wide ranging, so
yeah,
all over the place.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Yeah.